We live in the world, which is headed and run by the prince of the power of the air. But we live by the Spirit, discerning the times. For he who is spiritual discerns all things. Sharpen your discernment. Build your faith. Listen to the Word and World Team. Minister the Word of God through conversational theology, piercing the darkness of this present evil age.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Well, welcome back. This is Hampton Keithley with Bob Brandon, and we are continuing our book review of Rodney Stark's How the West Won. How are you today, Bob?
I don't think I'm as cold as you are.
Yes, the temperatures dropped 20 degrees between, I guess, 8 o'clock and 11 o'clock today. And it's supposed to go down to 7 or 8. And Dallas, Dallas doesn't know how to deal with that.
Well, what's that portend for your garden?
I built a plastic Quonset hut looking thing over the garden and stuck a space heater in there and going to try to save the lettuce. But the 40 mile an hour winds are killing me. So every hour I go out and tighten it back down.
Okay. Well, we're at about the same temperature this morning, you and I, and I'm in the middle of the Colorado mountains and you're in the plains of Texas.
Oh, and it was snowing just a few minutes ago, little flakes, but.
Oh my goodness.
And there were big flakes. I was talking with my buddy and that works on Bible.org with me. He lives in Denton and he said they had big flakes up there. So.
Oh boy. What do we got this morning, Hampton?
Well, today we're going to do chapters 3 and 4. 3 is the Roman interlude and 4 is the blessings of disunity.
Oh, good. Well, let's get to those lickety split as soon as we read Daniel chapter 4.
Okay.
Okay. So the reason we're reading from the book of Daniel is at that time in history. So the book of Daniel begins about 605 BC. Nebuchadnezzar had become king of Babylon after his father Nabopolassar died. And his reign began in about 605. So very early, you know, within the first year of his reign, he conquers Jerusalem, just like Jeremiah and just like Habakkuk said. And he was aware of what the prophets were saying. So he conquers Jerusalem. And the word on the street, is the way I like to put it, would have been, hey, Marduk, he's the god of Babylon, essentially. Marduk is tougher than Yahweh, because Nebuchadnezzar just conquered Jerusalem. So right. isn't that proof? Right.
Yeah.
And so you got God saying, not so quick, boys. You know, I'd check that logic a little bit and see what's happening. So right throughout the book of Daniel, you get this panoramic view of the history that will unfold upon the earth. And in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has his dream of the statue, and Babylon is the head of gold. And then you get Persia, shoulders, arms, chest of silver, then belly, upper thighs of bronze, that's Greece, and then Rome, the final empire to come upon the earth before Jesus returns. He's the stone cut out of the mountain without hands, right? Not a man-made kingdom, a divine kingdom, smashes the statue and sets up his dominion forever. So the book of Daniel, after that dream in chapter 2, really the rest of Daniel's kind of explaining that chapter. So here we are in chapter 4, later on in Nebuchadnezzar's life. Let me pause here before I read it, because there's another interesting tidbit, to me at least. So I think we've mentioned how the names in the ancient Near East were theophoric. That literally means, or they're really statements about God. So even Daniel, for instance, Daniel, you know, we just say Daniel, but literally it means the L is a generic term for God. The I is possessive. So my God, Don is the verb to judge. So my God is judge. That's what the name Daniel means. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is a fun one. So that's how we pronounce it. But the roots of that name are, you know, Nabu was one of the chief deities of Babylon. And Kad, you see that in the middle, Nebuchadnezzar. Mm-hmm. The Kad really is a word that has to do with like boundaries, but metaphorically it would be protection. Like a membrane almost, you know, protects the cell. The membrane's the boundary. But so Kad would mean in this case protect, and then Ezer is prince. So may Nabu protect the prince, right? He's the firstborn son. So anyway, it's just fun to see the names like that. So here we go, Daniel chapter 4. King Nebuchadnezzar. So it's a letter that Nebuchadnezzar's writing to his domain. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and language groups that live in all the land, peace and prosperity. I'm delighted to tell you about the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs! How mighty are his wonders! His kingdom will last forever. His authority continues from one generation to the next. So let's pause. So it looks like Nebuchadnezzar has found out that Yahweh's a little tougher than Marduk. In fact, there is no Marduk. There's
like to point out that in the Hebrew Bible, that's the end of chapter 3 and goes with the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Uh-huh.
And then they start the chapter 4 with
I was relaxing in my home. Yeah. And so that's another good plug for like the NET Bible, because the NET, which I'm reading from, NET, will explain that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We have in parentheses, we have the Hebrew verse numbers at the beginning, the end of chapters like that to let people know that maybe this should be considered, you know, with the previous section or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And it's good to point out too, because, you know, we just subtly accept these things if we don't think them through. But there, Daniel didn't write a big 4. And then a colon and then a 1, right? He's just writing text. You know, we put those chapters and verses in for reference.
You know, and I don't know if the Hebrew was like that, but in the Greek, they didn't even put spaces between the words.
But great. Oh, man, did I find that out the hard way one time. Oh, yeah, I know you're trying to rabbit trail me, but I'll address that at a later time. But anyway, so here we go. Unless any other comments, I'm going to start back up. Okay. So I, Nebuchadnezzar, was relaxing in my home, living luxuriously in my palace. I saw a dream that frightened me badly. The things I imagined while lying on my bed, these visions of my mind were terrifying me. So I issued an order for all the wise men of Babylon to be brought before me so that they could make known to me the interpretation of the dream. When the magicians, astrologers, wise men, and diviners entered, I recounted the dream for them, but they were unable to make known its interpretation to me. Later, Daniel entered, whose name is Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and in whom there is a spirit of the holy gods. I recounted the dream for him as well, saying, Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, in whom I know there to be a spirit of the holy gods, in whom no mystery baffles. Consider my dream that I saw and set forth its interpretation. Here are the visions of my mind while I was on my bed. While I was watching, there was a tree in the middle of the land. It was enormously tall. The tree grew large and strong. Its top reached far into the sky. It could be seen from the borders of all the land. Its foliage was attractive and its fruit plentiful. On it, there was food enough for all. Under it, the wild animals used to seek shade, and in its branches, the birds of the sky used to nest. All creatures used to feed themselves from it. While I was watching in my mind's visions on my bed, a holy sentinel came down from heaven. He called out loudly as follows: chop down the tree, lop off its branches, strip off its foliage, and scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches, but leave its taproot in the ground with a band of iron and bronze around it, surrounded by the grass of the field. Let it become damp with the dew of the sky, and let it live with the animals in the grass of the land. Let his mind be altered from that of a human being, and let an animal's mind be given to him. Let 7 periods of time go by for him. This announcement is by the decree of the sentinels. This decision is by the pronouncement of the holy ones, so that those who are alive may understand that the Most High has authority over human kingdoms, and he bestows them on whomever he wishes. He establishes over them even the lowliest of human beings. This is the dream that I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw. Now you, Belteshazzar, declare its interpretation, for none of the wise men in my kingdom are able to make known to me the interpretation, but you can do so, for a spirit of the holy gods is in you. Then Daniel, whose name is also Belteshazzar, was upset for a brief time. His thoughts were alarming him. The king said, Belteshazzar, don't let the dream and its interpretation alarm you. But Belteshazzar replied, Sir, if only the dream were for your enemies and its interpretation applied to your adversaries. The tree that you saw, that grew large and strong, whose top reached to the sky, and which could be seen in all the land, whose foliage was attractive and its fruit plentiful, and from which there was food available for all, under whose branches wild animals used to live, and in whose branches birds of the sky used to nest. It's you, O king, for you've become great and strong. Your greatness is such that it reaches to heaven, your authority to the ends of the earth. As for the king seeing a holy sentinel coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its taproot in the ground with a band of iron and bronze around it, surrounded by the grass of the field. Let it become damp with the dew of the sky, and let it live with the wild animals until 7 periods of time go by for him. This is the interpretation, O king. It's the decision of the Most High that this has happened to my lord, the king. You will be driven from human society. You will live with the wild animals. You'll be fed grass like oxen. You'll become damp with the dew of the sky. 7 periods of time will pass by for you before you understand that the Most High is ruler over human kingdoms and gives them to whomever he wishes. They said to leave the taproot of the tree, for your kingdom will be restored to you when you come to understand that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away from your sins by doing what's right, and from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps your prosperity will be prolonged. Now all this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. After 12 months, he happened to be walking around on the battlements of the royal palace of Babylon. the king uttered these words, "Is this not the great Babylon that I have built for a royal residence by my own mighty strength and for my majestic honor?" While these words were still on the king's lips, a voice came down from heaven. "It's hereby announced to you, King Nebuchadnezzar, that your kingdom has been removed from you. You'll be driven from human society. You'll live with the wild animals. You'll be fed grass like oxen. And 7 periods of time will pass by for you before you understand that the Most High is ruler over human kingdoms and gives them to whomever he wishes." Now, in that very moment, this pronouncement about Nebuchadnezzar came true. He was driven from human society. He ate grass like oxen. His body became damp with the dew of the sky, till his hair became long like an eagle's feathers, and his nails like a bird's claws. But at the end of the appointed time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, looked up toward heaven. My sanity returned to me. I extolled the Most High. I praised and glorified the one who lives forever, for his authority is an everlasting authority, and his kingdom extends from one generation to the next. All the inhabitants of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he wishes with the army of heaven and with those who inhabit the earth. No one slaps his hand and says to him, "What have you done?" At that time, my sanity returned to me. I was restored to the honor of my kingdom, and my splendor returned to me. My ministers, my nobles were seeking me out. I was reinstated over my kingdom. I became even greater than before. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven, for all his deeds are right and his ways are just. He's able to bring now down those who live in pride. That was Daniel chapter 4, Hampton.
Yeah. Well, so, and I guess we can take comfort that the Most High is ruler over human kingdoms and gives them to whomever he wishes.
That's right. So, there you go.
When we get a little despondent looking at who's running the country.
So. Yeah. We can't forget there are watchers in heaven, and God's actually not running it, but in control of it. Right. So
very good.
Okay.
Okay. Well, let's do chapter 3. It's called the Roman Interlude. And he says he calls it the Roman Interlude instead of the Roman Era because it was just an interlude to progress. And most people, think Rome was great and are probably unaware of the fact that they pretty much just adopted Greek culture and Greek language. They adopted their gods and renamed them. They copied their art and technology. And he said their only invention was concrete.
Yeah, interesting.
And they built a lot of huge arenas, the Colosseum being the one everybody thinks about.
Sure,
I guess they used the concrete to do that.
Yeah, still there. See that, we ought to almost do a whole study on just the Colosseum. What a fascinating structure. So Rome could build. They were very good at literally building. Right. They were very good with water.
Yeah, they built the aqueduct.
Right. And good with war. And that's about it.
Yeah, you often hear praise for the Roman road system.
Mm-hmm.
But he said that the actual road was really not very good. It was hard on the feet. It was slippery, uneven, too steep for carts. And people preferred to walk beside the road rather than on the road.
Yeah, the shoulder, right? That's where you wanted to be.
And they were only 10 feet wide, I think. So yeah. That's not too wide.
No.
But he said they used slaves rather than develop new technology, which is something that we've seen previously.
Yeah.
There's no motivation to adopt a technological invention, as it didn't save the Roman upper class any labor or time. They could just have their slaves do it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to read something he wrote. He said, meanwhile, the Roman elite grew fabulously wealthy as a result of military victories that brought home huge amounts of booty and enormous numbers of slaves. Plutarch estimated that Julius Caesar's campaign in Gaul yielded at least 1 million slaves. The constant flood of cheap slaves destroyed the population of independent farmers, their land being bought up and sometimes usurped to form huge latifundia, agricultural estates based on slave laborers, from the Latin latus, spacious, and fundus, farm or estate. The displaced farmers poured into Rome and other Italian cities, forming a dependent population that created political instability and that needed to be pacified with free bread and circuses. In fact, in every Roman city, large numbers qualified for free daily donations of bread, oil, olive oil, and wine. As Peter Heather pointed out in his History of the Roman Empire, seats in the arena were free, although the better ones cost money. The destruction of the independent farmers also deprived Rome of its most important source of citizen soldiers.
Yeah, farmers' sons. Yeah, you know, just for a heads up, you know, any mention of Caesar, oh my gosh, what a fantastic character in history. It not fantastic in the sense of great, but fantastic in the sense of pivotal or monumental. What a character. Oh man, imagine, you know, I've always thought about it this way. Caesar was not very far removed from the birth of Jesus Christ, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, within a generation.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the two greatest people in history right there together. I mean, some certainly would argue Caesar was one of the greatest in history. He's a marvel to me, but the best place to read about Caesar, if anybody's interested, is the series by Colleen McCullough about Julius Caesar. It's historical fiction, but she's done phenomenal research. You can understand that guy's life and its context. She favors Caesar. You know, she makes him out to be a hero. Might have been in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that you pointed out that paragraph, because it says the Roman elite became fabulously wealthy. And the American system that we live under closely parallels Rome. You know, just as Rome paralleled Greece, we've paralleled Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, when you amass such great wealth, I don't think there's ever been a nation as wealthy as the United States, you know, even right, comparatively, right? So when you amass wealth like that, elites take over. And that happened in Rome, and it's happened in our country as well.
Well, I can't help but think about the similarity of they bought up all that land, and that's like Bill Gates and BlackRock, I think, is another company.
Yep. Yeah.
They're buying up just tons of farmland. And so,
isn't that fascinating?
No longer the little farmer.
No, is that not fascinating how history repeats?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. So go ahead, take us further.
Okay, so then the next section is sports and entertainment. And that phrase bread and circuses. you know, they had to pacify the people with free food and entertainment. And that's very similar to kind of the stuff that's going on, I think, with all of our entertainment-based society. And then the elite today are talking about universal income. So,
yeah,
very similar.
Yeah, again, very, very similar. The Roman games. Oh, my gosh. You know who does a good job of portraying that? I'm not a movie guy, Hampton, but who hasn't seen
Gladiator.
Yeah. Oh boy, they do a good job of portraying that.
Yeah, the circuses were the sports in the places like the Coliseum and all the arenas they built around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And their sports weren't about winning the most points to win the game. The point of theirs was you kill your opponent.
Yeah, survival.
And
yeah.
So they celebrated people dying in the games. And mm-hmm. like you say, the gladiators are the most famous and by far the best movie ever about. Well, you know, there's Spartacus. I don't remember if he was a gladiator, but.
Oh, yeah, he was. Was he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was his name? Oh, Michael Douglas, not Michael Douglas, Kirk Douglas.
Yeah, I don't know those, but I remember the story in history, and that also you can get from Colleen McCullough, because Caesar at one point had to put down Spartacus, you know, when Caesar was climbing the ranks in, it's a fascinating story.
Well, he says, and of course, slaves were always fair game to be killed in various ways, but anyone could become a victim. Once when the supply of condemned criminals to be killed by wild animals ran out, the Emperor Caligula, there's another bad guy, ordered that the first several rows of spectators be thrown to the beasts. And so they were. So. And then
there's another funny theophoric name, Caligula, that literally means little boots, right? I think his dad might have been Tiberius or, yeah. You know, was a famous Roman general. And so Caligula grew up with the military, and mm-hmm. they would make fun of him as he stomped around. You know, they'd just call him little boots.
He went on to say in AD 108, 109, the Emperor Trajan employed 10,000 gladiators and 11,000 wild animals in an entertainment lasting 123 days.
Yeah.
And those entertainments continued until banned by Christian emperors in the 4th century.
Yeah. Oh, I think it was Germanicus that was Caligula's dad, but go ahead.
Anyway, Stark said approximately 2.5 million people died in the arenas.
Oh, died. Imagine the brutality of that. See, that's, again, the reason I would point that out is that's going to happen again. I think you will see that in the U.S.
That's hard to believe.
Don't underestimate the sin nature.
That's true. That's true. The next section is on the Roman army and how they fought and how they changed their tactics over the years. I thought it was interesting. There was 300,000 soldiers in the 1st century, and by the 3rd, it had grown to 600,000.
Well, their borders keep expanding.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And in 89, because I lived in Germany, this stood out to me. Three legions slaughtered by the Germanic tribes at Teutoburg Forest. And I went and looked that up on Google Maps. That was about 4 hours from where I lived, but it's 1,000 miles from Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're so spread out. And how long mm-hmm. would it? I mean, I'm 1,000 miles from you. I think it's 950 miles.
Long time.
How long would it take to walk?
Oh, man.
So,
yeah.
He said that the troops tended to give their loyalty to their generals rather than to Rome.
Right.
Which led to political instability, and the legions overthrew emperors and installed new ones on a regular basis.
Okay, let's pause there for a second. Because that observation, I'm certain, is accurate. You know, Caesar's soldiers, they're going to fight for Caesar. Even when Caesar rebels against all of Rome, they're going to fight for Caesar. So if we're parallel to Rome, how do you see that in our culture? Like, is an FBI agent loyal to the United States or to the FBI? Is a CIA agent loyal to the United States or to the CIA? Is a researcher, a medical researcher, loyal to the United States or the CDC and Anthony Fauci?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the same stuff happened in Rome, and it's happening in our country.
Yeah, I heard a really interesting podcast interview a couple months ago by an FBI agent that was basically a whistleblower, and he was saying that the January 6th investigation by the FBI, they've opened, I think there are about 200 people involved, and they've opened 200 separate cases instead of just one case with 200 participants, if you will. And the reason they did that was so that they could claim that there were all these different terrorists, groups going on. And the way they twist things like that, pretty interesting.
Yeah, we're becoming a police state.
That's all I was going to talk about with the soldiers for now. He then goes on to rise of Christianity. He said it spread quickly, and it said it spread amongst the upper class in the cities. And he pointed out
Okay,
that the
a little
word,
bit.
most
Let's
people think
pause.
it's the lower class where it spread.
I would have guessed that, but let's pause real quick to just point this out. Sorry to interrupt you. So that, the rise of Christian, Stark's not writing from a Christian perspective. I haven't ascertained. I mean, I don't know if he's may well be a man of faith, but he's certainly not writing this book from that perspective. And look where Christianity shows up in the middle of the Roman Empire. And what was Daniel's statue? The final part was a Roman Empire, and then here comes Jesus Christ in his kingdom, and it smashes the Roman Empire, and that crumbles the rest of the statue. It played out in history exactly like Daniel said. So go ahead. I'm sorry for that.
Well, one of his points was that the word pagan means country hick.
I
Okay.
guess that's
It was
me.
the folks in the rural areas that believed in the old gods, but it was spreading amongst the rich. And there was a lot of persecution, Nero in the 60s, and he went through a whole list of things. It was interesting, one guy stopped the persecution because his wife was a Christian. And one of the emperors. And then Diocletian, it says, although his wife and daughter were Christians, he started heavy persecution at the insistence of Galerius. And Galerius took over a couple years later and got real serious about persecution and was burning scriptures, arresting, torturing, and executing the leaders of Christian leaders. Then he got sick, canceled the persecution, and asked the Christians to pray for him. That was kind of crazy. And then Constantine declared his conversion to Christianity in 312 and made Christianity the Catholic or universal religion. And then
Yeah,
he said
just
he
as
meddled endlessly in church governance, and soon Christianity became a highly centralized bureaucracy modeled on the Roman state, and that was a bad thing.
yeah, that'll kill it, right? The persecution doesn't kill it. Persecution grows it. But become Christian and then morph it into your government. Yeah, that'll kill it.
And then I guess 410, the Goths conquered Rome. And historians have traditionally said this was a tragedy and the end of civilization, putting people back into barbaric living conditions, which we'll get to in the next chapter. But for the fall of Rome section, there seemed to be a lot of different opinions about what caused it. Some blamed it on Christianity, but Christianity was stronger in Eastern Europe and it didn't fall. Some blame it on economic decline. He said that the purchasing power of the population was diminishing. Sounds like today. Agriculture base passed through a terrible crisis. Prices constantly rose. The value of the currency depreciated at an unprecedented rate. The relations between the state and the taxpayer were based on more or less organized robbery. Doesn't that sound familiar?
It does.
Forced work, forced deliveries, forced loans and gifts were the order of the day. The administration was corrupt and demoralized. the most terrible chaos thus reigned throughout the ruined empire. So, sounds a lot like today.
It sure does. And then, you know, one thing I noticed too, you know, they talk about Rome defending her borders.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, we don't even do that.
Yeah. Well, the way, and he attributes that one of the main reasons for the fall was that they used to have their soldiers close to the borders,
mm-hmm.
and kind of, you know, able to support each other.
Mm-hmm. Mobile, very mobile.
Yeah, when they were attacked. But that meant long supply lines. And so they started pulling the troops back to the bigger cities and just leaving kind of scouts or little outposts. And if the barbarians came, then they jumped on their horses and rode back to the big city to get the soldiers. And then the soldiers would, you know, have to march out there. And so by the time they got out there, the attack was over.
Yeah, they're already overrun.
And they were, yeah. And so he also said that all these soldiers living in the big cities was not a good thing because they got soft.
Right. Right.
And the barbarians weren't really barbarians. They were the ones who invented soap. The farmers had iron plows. The metal of their swords was better. They had better footwear, better tactics. And he says many of the barbarian soldiers were actually former Roman soldiers who had switched sides. And in fact, Alaric, who led the Goths in the sack of Rome, was a former Roman soldier.
General or something, yeah.
He was almost made general. And when he didn't get made general, he quit.
Right.
And I think he said 30,000 soldiers quit with him and joined him and headed north.
Right.
And so the Rome was really, you know, taken over by a former Roman soldier. The point, I think, of this section was that the barbarians weren't a bunch of ignorant savages.
No, who'd have thought they invented soap?
Right.
The barbarians. You know, that reminds me of a joke, Hampton. Do you know where anthropologists today suspect the toothbrush was invented?
No.
Arkansas. Because had it been anywhere else, it would have been called the teeth brush.
Okay.
Okay, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, Tim Hawkins is, you know who he is, Christian comedian?
No.
So he's up on the stage and he's talking about people at the greeters at the church, and they've got the hand washing plunger thing sitting there on the counter. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, somebody comes in and shakes your hand, and they go over and he cleans his hands off with the sanitizer, and then he's asked them, the next person, where he's from. And he starts, you know, he like cleans his hands all the way up to the elbow. And then when he says to the next person, they says, where are you from? They say, from Arkansas. The guy dumps the whole thing on his head.
There you go.
So, okay.
Good one.
Anything else from chapter 3?
No, but let's read the final sentence paragraph.
I'm not there in my ebook, so you can read it.
But it was Rome that fell, not civilization. The Goths did not suddenly return to barbarism, nor did the millions of residents of the former empire suddenly forget everything they knew. To the contrary, with the stultifying effects of Roman repression now ended, the glorious journey toward modernity resumed. So that's why he calls it the Roman interlude. Like, right. there wasn't any progress because Rome just dominated. And you'll see that, you know, as history unfolds before the return of Christ, as the elites take over more and more of the U.S., we won't progress. Their whole goal will be to not let us progress so that they can remain elite.
Right.
So.
Okay, next section is called the Not So Dark Ages.
Yeah, what a misnomer.
Yeah, 500 to 1200.
So. But we all think of it that way, don't we?
We do.
And is that not really good evidence of the social imaginary?
Oh, yes.
Right? You just assume that because you've heard that, but you've never really studied it. And once you study it, you're going, well, it wasn't dark at all. There was tremendous progress made because there was no repressive empire.
Right, right. So the next chapter is called The Blessings of Disunity, and the prevailing teaching for the past 300 years or so. Maybe longer, has been that the fall of Rome plunged Europe into the Dark Ages. And he quotes people like Voltaire, Rousseau, Bertrand Russell in his famous mm-hmm. college textbook from 1959. And then he says, in 1993, the highly respected historian William Manchester summed up his views of the period 8400 and 81,000 in his book titled A World Lit Only by Fire. He dismissed those who no longer believed in the Dark Ages on grounds that most of what is known about the period is unlovely. The portrait that emerges is a melange, I guess,
melange.
A mixture of incessant warfare, corruption, lawlessness, obsession with strange myths. I wonder if he's concluding Christianity in that.
Yep.
And an almost impenetrable mindlessness. So that's 1993.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think, you know, all of these writers, Voltaire, you know, Rousseau, we already talked about him a lot, were all anti-Christian, and they blamed Christianity for the Dark Ages. And also, I think that the Enlightenment people called it the Dark Ages to make it sound, make themselves feel better.
Yeah, contrast. They're the Enlightenment,
right?
So they're contrasting it with the darkness, the Dark Ages.
Yeah, and he pointed out that it is true that all of the cities either declined or just ceased to exist. But that
the Roman city,
yeah, the Roman cities. But that was because the cities were centers of consumption and not production.
Correct.
And they were dependent on the people in the countryside to grow their food. And when there was no government with soldiers left to go forcibly take the food and taxes, then they were forced to move to the country and start growing their own food.
Yes.
And, you know, smaller villages sprung up everywhere, and there was a lot of trading and manufacturing and that kind of stuff. So right. People ate better. They grew larger. They had a better standard of living.
That'd be a good, right? That would be a good way to say it. You know, my fondness for trivia, right? It would be a fun question to ask. You know, were people larger during Roman rule or during the Dark Ages? And the answer is the Dark Age. They ate better. Society was progressing. Right, as opposed to Roman repression. That'd
right.
be a good trivia.
Yeah, I think he might. I haven't read far enough ahead, but I read this book years ago, and I'm remembering that the horses and the people, you know, from Europe were so much bigger than the Muslim,
mm-hmm.
and that they were, you know, that helped in the battles.
Mm-hmm.
Those big horses would just could run over the others. There wasn't a lot written during that time in the Dark Ages, and so that, you know, that wasn't a leisure class with time on their hands to write, but that's probably one of the reasons people called the period the Dark Ages.
Mm-hmm.
So
good observation.
Then he talked about technological process. I'm just going to read it. It says, perhaps the most remarkable aspect of the Dark Ages myth is that it was imposed on what was actually one of the great innovative eras of mankind. During this period, technology was developed and put into use on a scale no civilization had previously known. It was during the supposed Dark Ages that Europe took the great technological and intellectual leaps forward that put it ahead of the rest of the world. It was an era of sustained growth. While the Eastern Empire was one, that time was one of decay. But, you know, they invented metal plows, food production doubled. They invented or started using horse-drawn plows. I think they figured out how to put what's the thing that the horse pulls against with his chest instead of a yoke? Horseshoes, crop rotation, water mills, dams.
Stirrups for your horse, for battle.
They built all those windmills and pumped the land dry up in the Netherlands.
Yeah, and they were very good at water power, like the mills, right? Using the rivers to generate the power to grind the wheat.
And they figured out it was better to have the water pouring over the water mill gave more power than just having the paddle stuck down in the water.
Yeah, so the speed and the weight of it, as opposed to just the current.
So, and they invented wagons with front wheels that could swivel and
break. Yeah, the axle, the front axle, yeah.
So I never thought about having a wagon that the wheels wouldn't turn. That'd be terrible.
It is interesting reading this stuff, you know, like how things came about. It just makes you think, you know, how much it just in our lifetimes, our culture has progressed technologically. I mean, it's hard to imagine.
I remember some guy that ran the U.S. Patent Office right back in 1910 or something like that, making the comment that everything that can be invented has.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What a blunder.
Yeah.
Well, how many, since you're rabbit trailing me, this will only take 30 seconds. About how many patents are granted in the U.S. every year?
10,000.
About 30,000.
Oh, 30,000.
Yeah, that's a pretty good guess, though. And since the year 2000, one third of those, so 10,000 a year, have pertained to coronavirus.
That's a lot of patents.
Yep. That fact alone ought to open everybody's eyes as to what's really going on with this. But go ahead.
Let's see, where was I? Well, there were advances made in music. They made musical notation. And that's how come we can know how to sing Gregorian chants. Because
it's polyphony, not symphony.
Huh?
Polyphony, not symphony.
Yes, I didn't know that. Right, they didn't do harmony before.
Right, right.
So that was kind of interesting. They had advances in architecture, those Gothic cathedrals.
Yeah, with the flying buttress. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And they started using oil paint and canvas during this time frame.
Yeah. And
I guess before that, you just did paint it on wood and rocks. I don't know.
Let me interrupt you because I want to put out there another good trivia question.
Okay.
So when we mention the name of the country, England, the etymology of that name was so fun when I read it. So England means land of Angles, like the Anglo-Saxon. Yeah. Anglo-Saxon, England, the land of the Anglos. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. He said it has a section called Chronic Warfare and Constant Innovation. And there was a lot of warfare between the lords and the knights. And, you know, I thought it was interesting. He didn't really talk about the feudal system, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of left that out. But with all that fighting came more inventions like chain mail armor and crossbows.
Okay.
Stirrups on saddle.
There you go. Here's a good trivia, Hampton. Another one. How many little circles in a chain mail shirt? How many rings?
I don't know. I think he said that, but I don't remember the number. Thousand?
25,000.
25,000.
Can you imagine? I can't imagine wearing that thing.
Oh, Yeah, that you'd have to be a big, strong guy to wear that. Be like David and Goliath, you know.
Yeah.
So he did spend a lot of time describing battles, and I found it interesting, but I don't really want to, you know, go over those. To just suffice it to say that the advances enabled the Europeans to defeat the Muslims when they invaded from Spain.
Correct.
And he goes through several of those battles and kind of culminates with Charlemagne.
Yeah, the grandson of Charles Martel.
There you go.
So that's a fun name too. Martel means hammer. So Charles the Hammer, you know, a Frank warrior, and then his grandson ends up being Charlemagne. So all of these names, you know, referring to Charles. But it was very interesting when, well, let me read these last few sentences in that section. Charles, like, but that's not how the battle was seen from Spain. Like, Spain didn't think, or a lot of historians didn't think these Frank victories were that important. But that's not how the nation of Spain thought about it. Spanish Muslims were fully aware of who Charles Martel was and what he'd done to their aspirations. They had learned from their defeat that the Franks were not a sedentary people, served by mercenary garrison troops, nor were they a barbarian horde. They too were empire builders, and the Frankish host was made up of well-trained citizen volunteers who possessed arms, armor, and tactics superior to those of the Muslims. The Muslims tried to invade Gaul once more in 735, but Charles Martel and his Franks gave them another beating so severe that Muslim forces never ventured north again. Martel defeated not only the Muslim invaders, but nearly every other group in Western Europe. At his death, the Frankish realm included most of what had once been the Western Roman Empire, except for Spain, Italy, and North Africa. Martel's conquests also extended to some of the Germanic areas that had never been part of Rome. His grandson expanded the realm to create a new Roman Empire. And then that begins the section, the Carolingian interlude.
Right.
So Carolingian is just, you know, an adjective that comes out of the name like Charles or Charlemagne. And what happens is it doesn't take. They create it, right? But it doesn't endure. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is you remember Jesus when the disciples ask him in Matthew 24, you know, hey, look at these great buildings. And they're pointing out the temple. And Jesus says, yeah, not one stone is going to be left upon another. And then they go, well, when's the end of the age? And he says, he begins to describe that and says, you know, you're going to hear wars and rumors of wars, but these are the beginning of birth pangs. And so it's almost a perfect example with Charlemagne trying to redo the Roman Empire, but it doesn't take. And it's like watching a fetus develop. And at that point of the fetus's development, right, the birth pangs, then morphed again into something else, but it wasn't time for its birth. And that's what I would present to our listeners is how to view history since Daniel chapter 2 is that Roman Empire is eventually going to be reborn and to look for that. So
Well,
that's all.
yeah, he pointed out that if Charlemagne's empire had lasted, that would have been a bad thing because we'd be back, you know, with no technological progress. And so he says, you know, fortunately it fell apart and Europe's precious disunity was restored.
The precious disunity. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thought about. I apply this maybe even to denominations in churches. You know, when you have a common Catholic doctrine and giant church where everybody falls in line, when things go bad, everybody is suffering from that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got all these different denominations with different doctrines, and certainly not everybody is right, but I wonder how that applies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, the same general principle, right? The more that a solid structure gets put in place, then the more the efforts go into maintaining that structure at the expense of individual rights. Right. And where progress really comes from is individual humans. Mm-hmm. It doesn't come from the gross superstructure. It comes from the roots of the people themselves.
Right. Right. Well, let's see here. Let me read the last paragraph. And it says, the final blow to the myth of the Dark Ages is that Rome was not conquered by barbarians. In terms of some technology, such as metallurgy, the people of the north were well ahead of the Romans. They had cities. They had extensive trade networks. And when their turn came, they launched a post-imperial era of progress. The Franks almost reimposed an empire that no doubt would have derailed that progress. Fortunately, the Carolingian Empire was short-lived.
There you go.
There's a lot of facts that we are skipping over, but I think he does a good job with supporting his points.
Yeah, it's a bird's eye view, of course.
Yeah, you're just hitting the highlights, but yeah. He does a great job.
Well, and I want to reemphasize, you know, as we wind this down, beware of the social imaginary, right? How many things you believe just because they're repeated in our culture. But when you need to know a certain subject, such that you're making decisions about your life, stuff like that, you got to dig in. You just cannot accept what our culture generally believes. You got to do your research, find out the truth about what has happened.
Okay. Anything else?
I'm good for today, Hampton.
Okay. Well, I'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Therefore, I exhort you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a sacrifice, alive, holy, and pleasing to God, which is your reasonable service. Do not be conformed to this present world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may test and approve what is the will of God, what is good and well-pleasing, and perfect.